so some of you were here last week, and I guess it was Thursday and Friday, gave a couple of lengthy tutorials, I guess they were called, about how genome evolution evolves in a non-adaptive manner, in particular in populations with sufficiently small size where drift just overwhelms selection in many contexts. And today I want to shift gears a little bit and focus on aspects of evolution of what I call complex adaptation. So by complex adaptation, I'm talking about an adaptation that requires more than one mutation to give rise to the new adaptive allele. So today is largely about natural selection, which gives me great pleasure to talk about, because I sort of have this reputation apparently of not believing in natural selection, which isn't strictly true. As I pointed out, you know, what is true is I feel very strongly we need a null hypothesis for evolution as to what would be expected in the absence of selection if we want to invoke selection. I actually had a grant proposal at NSF last year. One of the reviewers claimed I had disdain for natural selection and a complete misunderstanding of natural selection. And of course, you have to respond to reviewers, you know, when you revise your proposal, responding to a comment like that was not a whole lot of fun. In any event, here's what we mean by complex adaptation. This would be a three-step model where you require, you start out with some ancestral state. The reason I think I've been asked to present this is a lot of what's going to be discussed here over the next two or three, four, I guess 8 weeks, whatever, is really about complex adaptations. In general, it's not going to be about a single amino acid change and you've got, you're off on some new adaptive state. And the journal club we just had is a pretty dramatic example of this, how complex things can be. And what we'd really like to understand are the general rules by which evolution proceeds when a complex adaptation that the intelligent designers sometimes call this irreducible complexity, that these intermediate states don't get you anywhere. It's not until you've gotten over there that you've got a full-fledged advantage. So here we're starting out with an example cartoon of a three-step model. So you need three steps to get a new novel adaptation that's beneficial with respect to fitness. And this could be anything. This could be a single protein where you need three specific amino acid changes to have a new function. It could be a series of interactions. It could be a network in some sense. Of three different genes that are interacting with each other. It could be an intron being added to a gene where you have, you know, three sites, the 5', 3' splice site and the branch point or something. It's any kind of adaptation that involves three changes, and we'll generalize then to any number of changes. So we start with this ancestral state here, and I'm focused here initially on situations where there's no recombination between the sites. So it might be easiest for you to think about this as a protein. We're going to need three changes. And what can happen here is that one of these amino acids changes. And so here's three possible descendant alleles. So there's three steps here, but there's different pathways to the final solution of the problem. So here's the three potential initial steps. And then once you're here, you can take two steps to get your second mutation. And then finally, there's only one step. And so these blue balls mean that the intermediate states they could be neutral. So S1 is we're just indexing thing. This is the baseline fitness. And then as you add one of these, any number of these intermediate states, just to keep things simple, we say there is a reduction in fitness equal to S1, which is some number between 0 and 1. A 1 would be a lethal, and the talk's over. If they're lethal, we can't ever get to the right. Okay, good. If S1 is 0, which is quite possible, these intermediate states are simply neutral. They're not harmful, but they don't get you a new adaptation. But finally, when you've got all three of these specific mutations, you have some selective advantage over this ancestral allele. So the population's evolved to a new higher fitness state. And there's a lot of hard math involved in this stuff, and I'm reducing this mostly to cartoon fashion. I know Boris this, and I guess Richard, you've been involved in some of this, and maybe some other people in the room, but I'll show you some fairly general results, I think, that...
Why do you sell that tree and not that tomb?
I guess maybe because I made this late last night, and that's an excellent question. A two-win situation, we just remove one of these balls, and then you could go from here to either this or this, one of these, and then the next mutation brings you to home plate. Okay, so this is kind of like a baseball game, you know. Actually, it's not even a baseball game. First, I don't know, home plate, first plate, second plate, base. I don't play baseball. And you're home again, so I guess we skip third base. But you get the point here. You haven't really accomplished anything until you get to home plate.
And the blue, what do your colors mean?
Blue means an intermediate state. And so these are still the same mutations they are back here, but I'm just trying to indicate with red that you've got a protein with a new adaptive function you didn't have before. Okay?
And you're not allowing it to go backward?
You could allow things to go backward, but because these are very specific mutations, the back mutation to the specific ancestral state is going to be a relatively low frequency event, and it really won't change the results that I'm talking about. But it's a good question. Okay, so what can the thing here, the big issue here is the routes from here to here can vary dramatically depending on the size of the population. And in particular, the problem here is that this is a deleterious state here. How do you want it, you, speaking in very loose terms, you'd like to be over here because that's better than here, but the only way you'd be able to get over there perhaps would be going through a valley in fitness. You'd have to accept a reduction in fitness and then cross that valley to get over here, and that's not how natural selection works. Natural selection favors advances in fitness, not reductions in fitness. On the other hand, if the population size is small enough and the selective advantage isn't too great, you can, in fact, just accidentally accumulate these intermediate steps. And so I've drawn a couple cartoons here to sort of pictorialize how progression from the left to the right there might proceed in a very small versus a large population. If the population, so what we're viewing, these little trajectories are trajectories of new mutant alleles that come in, and the scale here would be 0 to 1. That's their frequency in the population. So we start over here with all the alleles, all the copies in the population are that string with the three white balls on it. And then in a small population, what's going to be going on is one of those intermediate state alleles will arise in the population. Most of the time, they'll just arise and drift, be lost from the population, because the probability of fixation, if this is neutral, is just equal to the initial frequency. So if the population size were 1,000 and it's a diploid, the probability of this actually drifting to fixation is 1 over 2,000. So almost always new mutant alleles, even if they're favorable, they usually drift out very quickly because they're just present in one copy in the very first generation. There's a sampling problem. So in this small population, there's one wasn't successful, there's another that wasn't successful, and there would be lots more in here. And here's one that actually drifted all the way to fixation. So the population goes to fixation for an intermediate state allele. And this can happen, as I said, even if it's slightly deleterious, if the power of drift just overwhelms selection, if it's stronger than the power of selection, you can, in fact, get stuck in the valley initially. But the point here is that the population's gone from this pure white state to a pure blue state. Now there's only one allele in the population, one of those intermediate state alleles. And then you're waiting around for the second mutation to arise. And sometimes those will be lost, but they're advantageous. So when one does appear finally and is destined to fixation, it'll essentially approach fixation exponentially. So what's going on in a small population is the origin of the adaptation proceeds in an essentially stepwise fashion. You go from a state of a population all like this to something all like just one of these would be there, and then all like one of these, and then all like one of these. But these different alleles are never coexisting, at the same time. And the reason is the population is small enough and the mutation rate is low enough, so the time to fixation is much more rapid than the arrival time of the next mutation. I've really condensed things here just so you can see it. Most of the time, nothing would be happening. You would go to one of these states, and then you're just waiting and waiting and waiting for the next mutation. So the interesting thing is, for small populations, you can go through a population bottleneck by random genetic drift and then emerge on the other side.
So you restrict yourself to this case where you don't have coexisting?
Oh, no, not at all. That's what I'm bringing up now. We're going to look at a whole range of population sizes, and I'm just trying to give you a cartoon view of two extremes. Now, let's suppose we have a large population. Now things are, the route to the final adaptation can be dramatically different, because there's many more mutational targets here. Mutational targets are the individuals and the genes they carry themselves. So suppose this intermediate state allele is actually deleterious. Now, if the population's really large, it will never be able to go to fixation, because drift will be a very weak force. The deleterious mutation will never go to fixation. The intermediate state will never fix. But on the other hand, there's a large number of individuals in the population, and there's always somebody arising with this new deleterious intermediate state mutation. There's this constant input. This is the problem we have. This is why we have genetic disorders at some low frequency of typically about 1,000, 1 in 1,000 gene copies for any typical human disorder will be non-functional. So this new deleterious intermediate state's coming in all the time, but selection's also removing each new deleterious allele. If, roughly speaking, if the selective disadvantage is S1, then the longevity of a new deleterious mutant allele is just 1 over the selective disadvantage. It just exponentially declines. That would be expected lifespan. So one of these new mutant alleles that, say, had a 10% reduction in fitness, it would be eliminated from the population in about 10 generations. So that's the good news. The bad news is, coming in behind it is just another cohort of deleterious mutations and so on. And so what you actually reach is a selection, what we call a selection mutation balance. The deleterious allele is just basically maintained at some low level by selection mutation balance. And that's nothing more than the ratio of the rate of input to that allele to the rate of output. Pretty simple. But what's interesting about this is, so this large population's never going to fix for the deleterious allele. But what's interesting is, because of this selection mutation balance, these intermediate state alleles are always sitting there in the population at some low frequency, and then they're poised to get the next mutation, and then away you go. So the beauty of this situation in large populations is that even if the intermediate states are deleterious, this is what people in cancer theory call stochastic tunneling. This happens in cancer. This is the way most of us get cancer. People talk about a two-hit or a three-hit model. One way you can get cancer is if you've got a cell in a tissue that perhaps has got one of the mismatch repair genes knocked out. This is called Lynch syndrome. I like to tell this story. And that means you're fine with only one allele for mismatch repair, because it's what we would call a haplo-sufficient locus. One copy is good enough. But now, if the second copy gets hit, away you go. That's very deleterious. So this is and that's why it's called stochastic tunneling. You just got one cell that's poised to go on to the next step. That's cancer. That sounds really bad for us, but if you just think about it in terms of the cancer cells, that's adaptive for that second cell to get the mutation, because away it goes at the population level. Okay. But here, what's happening is these guys are maintained at a low frequency, and then one copy of these gets the lucky last hit, and away it goes. So the population evolves to a new adaptive state without ever going through a bottleneck. And so I've spent some time trying to work out the math on this, and I'll just say that the analytical solutions are going to be given by these wiggly lines throughout, and then the various data points there are from computer simulations. So this is all done in the context of a traditional population genetic model. So what this plot is meant to do is to give us some idea of the rate of origin of the adaptation when the intermediate states are actually neutral. So all S1 is equal to zero, so all those intermediate states are equivalent in fitness to the original allele. And you just have to wander across until you get a certain number of mutations. So this is the result. For the two-hit model, it takes two mutations to get to the final solution. This is the three-hit model that I had shown, and then there's results for four and five. And so this is the scaling of the mean time to fixation in generations as a function of the genetic effective size of a population. And this is using data, the kinds of data that I showed you last week that we've acquired over the past decade or so on mutation rates in organisms. This is based on real known mutations. This is all modeled, but the mutation rate being used, it's important to use the right mutation rate, because if the rate that you're using is too low, then these times will be bewilderingly high. And we're really trying to get at what are the realistic times for the origin of a complex adaptation.
And so S1 is negative, or that is the first mutation?
S1, so if we go back here.
And S2 is positive, that is what you call them.
No, this is zero. So these guys have the same fitness as these. These have the same fitness as these, and then these get a boost.
And that gets a boost.
So you're just wandering across here neutrally until some copy gets all three of these guys, and then you're propelled to...
And what are you assuming for S2?
S2 is, in that particular slide, I think was 0.02. 2% selective advantage for the final allele. It's not a huge selective advantage.
I remember right, you had data for mutation rate, but you didn't have data for...
Not for selection coefficients. We don't know what your average selection coefficient is, but a 2% selective advantage, it's probably a moderately high selective advantage, actually. It's for the way to think about this, a 2% selective advantage would mean that you as an individual carrying this allele would have 2% better survivorship to maturity, or produce on average 2% more kids. Keeping in mind the kids actually come in discrete packages, of course.
I wasn't at your talk, but I read the paper, and you showed various scaling laws for mutation rates and generation times, sizes of the organisms.
Right.
How does generation time scale with that? And so if you actually did not generations, but...
Yeah, so this is time in generation. So over here, these would be microbes. And so a generation for a microbe would be 20 minutes. So this... over here, 10,000 generations or so, I can't do the math in my head, but we're talking about less than a year, actually, okay? Mammals would be over somewhere around here, and a generation could be, for a rodent, a third of a year. A lot of mammals would be less than a year. For us, it's going to be more like 20 years or so. Okay, so that's how you would convert this to a per year basis. Okay, so this is showing us the scaling of the time to adaptation with different complexities. And here, I'm using this word again, but I think you know what I mean here. Different levels of complexity of the adaptation. And what you can see in every case, regardless of the number of mutations you need, it declines, the time to adaptation declines with increasing population size. So that's sort of a unifying feature of this model. But there's some pretty neat things to take home messages from this simple plot. First, at small population sizes, you'll notice that the rate of adaptation is, it takes a long time, because now you're going through this sequential model. You're fixing the first mutation, then you're just sitting there for thousands of generations before the next one even arises in somebody, and then so on and so on. But what's interesting here is, regardless of whether you need only two to five mutations, the times don't change all that much. So a more complex adaptation arises almost as rapidly as a less complex one. And the reason for this is that although here you require two steps and here you require five steps, there's multiple paths in the five-step model. So the first mutation can, the first mutation can only be two possible things. The first ball gets hit or the second ball gets hit. But here, there's five possible first steps. Five possible ways to first base, so to speak. Four possible ways to second base, three to third, and two to home plate. So, okay? And so what's happening is these more complex adaptations, although there's more steps that need to be taken, there are more ways, there's more paths, and they essentially, they almost balance out. So that's the situation for small population sizes. And then large population size result is also quite interesting. Here we're dealing with really, truly enormous population sizes, but you know, 10 to the 11th isn't out of the question for a microbial population, even remotely. And one can actually simply derive an analytical solution to the results out here in the following way. Population size is so large here, drift is essentially playing no role at all. You have your original allele, and every one of those sites is mutating at rate U, and after T time units, each site will have a probability of having mutated equal to UT, and then if D is the total number of sites, UT to the D power is the probability that every site will have been hit. That's all there is to it. And so this is because all the intermediate states are neutral, and you're just being pushed along. The frequency of the one step, two step, three step, so on mutations are all increasing through time. Once that final beneficial mutation, just by mutation pressure, reaches this frequency here, and you'll have to take my word for this, but once it reaches this frequency, then new mutant type is essentially deterministically going to go to fixation. So what we can do is, this is the probability that you're at the final step at time t. We set that equal to this and just solve for t, and that's our result for the mean time to fixation. And there's some really remarkable features here. I mean, part of the reason I got into this work was I've had to unfortunately been pulled into a lot of these intelligent design debates and have had to deal with some papers that these guys have tried to write. And you recall that one of the arguments about irreducible complexity is that the idea is if you require five mutations, then the probability of getting a mutant allele with five mutations is the mutation rate to the fifth power, and if the mutation rate's like 10 to the minus 9, this is an astronomically small number. And what I'm pointing out here is that it's the time to adaptation isn't proportional, inversely proportional to the rate to the number of mutations. It's just inversely proportional to the mutation rate, period, at large population sizes. So it's not increasing with the number of steps at all. The number of steps comes in here, and what you can also see, I find kind of interesting, is that these curves become flatter and flatter as the number of steps increases. So that tells us for complex adaptations that more and more complex, the playing field is sort of evened out regardless of the population size. So the reason I'm trying to do this work is to try and understand what are the paths, likely paths, to the origin of an adaptation.
Do you worry at all that it depends on the distribution of S's that you go through? I mean, you did assume, right?
Well, this is the formula, so if you...
But you assume, though, that, you know, that there were whatever neutral mutations.
Yeah, I'm going to go through the next slide will be where the intermediate step is actually deleterious. This is just where the intermediate steps are neutral. And there's evidence from data on proteins that this is a realistic possibility. But in reality, you can think about this final adaptation. There might be a route through a series of neutral steps. There might be some alternative route that requires fewer steps, but the intermediate steps are deleterious. So that's the kind of thing we're trying to figure out. One interesting thing is, imagine, make D larger and larger and larger, then this whole term goes away and this just goes to 1 over the mutation rate. This would become a completely flat curve. So there's some neat scaling properties here.
Unless it becomes logarithmic. Sometimes in physics we say when an exponent's going to 0, it's an indication that you get a... what are you saying, when D goes to infinity?
Yeah, this to the Dth power will be... Anyhow, you can see that it becomes increasingly flat. So what else did I want to say here? I think that's one of the things I wanted to say. Oh, the thing I'm not going to talk about today, but I did talk about last Thursday, is that we know that small populations evolve higher mutation rates. And this is simply because the mutation rate's already very low. The strength of selection to reduce the mutation rate any further is a pretty weak force, so that small populations will naturally evolve a higher mutation rate just because drift overwhelms your ability to keep it down as low as you'd want. So in reality, the mutation rate would be increasing and going in this direction, and that would bring down, that would sort of bring, if you think of, make this these plots into just sort of rubber bands, and we stretch this down, it would overall flatten the whole distribution here, bringing these mutation rates even, or the times to fixation, what I'm calling time to establishment, I guess, is even more biologically real. So this is the case in which all the intermediate steps are neutral. And you can certainly argue that in many cases, the intermediate steps to a new adaptation will be deleterious sometimes. I mean, maybe you want a cysteine-cysteine bond someplace, and you start off with one over here, and now you want one over here, but you've got to break that one there, and you're temporarily without any, and that's not so good for your protein. You can envision situations where the intermediate steps are deleterious. And here's the results for deleterious intermediate steps. Again, for 2, 3, 4, and 5-step results, the lines are the analytical solutions, and the data, the computer simulations fit them pretty well. So I think the analytical solutions are quite trustworthy. So just a couple of things to point out. In small populations, again, the time to adaptation is almost independent of the level of complexity of the adaptation. And again, that's because in small populations, really, these are really tiny. These are ridiculously small. I'm just giving you the full set. A population of size 1 is not going to adapt. It's going to go to extinct for any number of reasons. But I'm just giving you the complete picture here. But what's interesting here is when the intermediate states are deleterious, populations of intermediate size adapt the most slowly. Okay? And that can be thought of in the following way. Remember, we just talked about these two paths of the final adaptation. One is the sequential or the stepwise model, where you fix and then you sit there waiting and waiting for the next mutation, and finally you get it and away you go. And the other is the stochastic tunneling model, where the intermediate states are maintained by selection mutation balance, which is clearly the case here because these intermediate states are deleterious. And then you finally get a mutation and away you go. So the issue here is that in intermediate population size, you're in the worst of all possible worlds. You can't, you're too big to do the stepwise thing. Right, because you're big enough so that drift overwhelms the power of selection overwhelms drift. So you can't drift to fixation of the intermediate state. You can over here, but you can't here. The population is just too large. But on the other hand, it's not large enough to have a lot of targets for stochastic tunneling. There's not a lot of bodies out there mutating for stochastic tunneling. So here, the sequential fixation model is not working all that, method is not working all that well, and neither is stochastic tunneling. And then once you pass the peak here, then it's all stochastic tunneling. Over here, the adaptation is always arising by this kind of pathway. Okay, so the population's never becoming maladaptive in getting to here. It's got to fix 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 intermediate states. but it's never going to fixation perennials. They're all kept at a low level. And you can get these, again, there's a lot of math involved, but I think there's an intuitive way of thinking about why these lines lie where they are. So the reason is, I've already pointed out, so if all the intermediate steps are deleterious, they have a selective disadvantage of S1. And so imagine an intermediate step allele coming in. It's only going to be around for 1 over S1 generations. So if this is a selective disadvantage of 1%, it'll be around for 100 generations on average, but selection will get it out of there on average in 100 generations. Okay? So that's, if you've got a first step allele, what you have to do, it's sitting, it's arisen in the population, and suppose it's a five-step model, it's got to pick up four other mutations within this number of generations, because it's going to be eliminated, right? It's declining over time, and the race is on. It's got to get that many mutations. So one U over S1 is...
The model is that each of the intermediate steps has the same...
They're equally disadvantage. Yeah, in this case, the first one's disadvantageous, but the next one is just as bad as the first one, right? So
no better, no worse.
It's neutral in some sense compared to the last deleterious one, but they're still deleterious compared to where you started. Okay, so U over S1, that's the probability of getting a mutation at that site before you're eliminated by selection. Because 1 over S1 is the time, the number of generations, and you're mutating in each generation at rate U. And we have to mutate all D sites. And so that's the probability of getting all D mutations before you're eradicated. And so that's where that scaling comes from. And this D factorial is just associated with the number of paths that I talked about. And the N there is N's the number of individuals mutating. And then S2 is the rate at which you're pulled up, and S1 the rate at which you're pulled down. That's the result. As I said, there's a lot more mathematical detail that goes into this, but the data over here fit remarkably well. So I'm just presenting this all to you to give you an idea of what you need to think about when we're starting to think about these origins of complex cellular adaptations, what kinds of evolutionary trajectories are and aren't possible in populations of various sizes. Again, the population size really matters in terms of what evolutionary pathways you can take. So with the neutral intermediate pathway, it was monotonic decreasing, but here there's a peak in the middle. The worst place for evolving through a bottleneck is if you're at an intermediate population size. And this is interesting here, that large populations are reaching the adaptation most rapidly, because historically population geneticists have always felt, had this intuitive feeling going back to Sewell Wright, that the only way, that you had to have small populations to get to a new adaptation where you go through a bottleneck, because the old idea is that's the only way you could wander across the fitness valley. But with stochastic tunneling, you don't have to go through a fitness valley at all. Just one rare individual gets multiple individuals, and it doesn't affect the fitness of the whole population. It's a very rare event, but in large populations, there's a lot of individuals playing that game. So something else that I just wanted to get some of the guys here that are working on these kinds of things, and Boris and I've talked about a little. Even at this point, while I'm showing you this talk, I'm running some simulations on my laptop. The models that I've been talking about up to now, there's no recombination between the sites. That's why I said you can think about it maybe most easily as a protein evolving. But now, think of something like the nuclear pore complex, you know, if we dare think about that anymore. The different loci might be on completely different chromosomes, or the dots might be different loci on a chromosome or something, but there's going to be a certain amount of recombination between the mutations. In the last model, that whole gene was inherited as a unit with no recombination between the different sites. And so this is a difficult problem that folks have struggled with for a long time. What does, is recombination good or bad for evolutionary progress? So the good news is that recombination can facilitate the arrival of a new mutant allele. So for example, suppose in the three-step model we got out there somewhere around second base or wherever it was, and all the alleles, or a lot of the alleles, have two mutations in them. So with no recombination, the only way this guy could get to here is for that to pick up a mutation. And you know, the mutation rate's on the order of 10 to the minus 8, 10 to the minus 9 per cell division. But if you had that allele in the population with that allele, and it's a diploid individual having a sexual reproduction, if you had a crossover event between here, you would produce, you'd bring this guy up there, and then you would have produced the advantageous allele by mutation, by recombination. And of course, you would have lost, this other recombinant would have taken one step backwards. But recombination provides a mechanism for creating the adaptive allele, in principle getting you there a little faster than you'd want to. That's recombination is really a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it provides a mechanism for producing the new novel adaptation, but it also provides a nice mechanism for breaking it. Because now suppose this allele's in the population and it recombines with this allele, you've taken a step back. So this is the problem with recombination. On the one hand, in small enough populations, it can facilitate the production of these guys. But on the other hand, when one of these arises, and especially in a small population, almost everybody else is going to be non-self, right? Especially when everybody else will be non-self when you first create this. So you'll always be breaking, whenever you undergo recombination, you'll be breaking this adaptive combination. And so the question is, which one of these processes wins? And does recombination, or do they just balance out? Does the advantage here get completely balanced out by the disadvantage here, so recombination doesn't matter at all? And so here's the case for situation with, again, we're back to the model where all the intermediate states are neutral. This is just the two-hit model. So this line here, my plotting program just ran out of symbols and things, but this line here is this line here. It's the two-hit model without recombination. And then we're looking what happens when you add recombination. And it turns out, for a good bit of the region of population sizes, not a whole lot happens. At small population sizes, recombination has no impact whatsoever. And that makes sense, because remember, at small populations, you're just drifting from one fixed state to the next fixed state to the next fixed state. And so even if you're recombining with your own allelic type, you don't produce anything new. So that's clearly what we expect to see out here. At moderate population sizes, these would actually be pretty, this would be something on the order of a unicellular eukaryote. This is a recombination rate of 10 to the minus 5 per generation between the sites. So that's very, very weak recombination. Free recombination, if the genes were on different chromosomes, the recombination would be equal to 0.5. That's free recombination. So this is very weak recombination, but it does reduce the time to establishment. So there's a slight advantage of recombination at populations of intermediate size, but in sort of the grand scheme of things, it's not a huge advantage. It's by a factor of 10, okay. For me, that's, you know, it's biology. Anything less than a factor of 10 is, I should be quiet here, so.
Also, okay. And then, non-monotonic, could you do, why is it non-monotonic?
Well, I'll show you in a second what we think is going on. And this came out of a conversation with Boris the other day. At large population sizes, you see some very interesting behavior. For all these weak levels of recombination, doesn't matter. You still get to the adaptation quite quickly. And that's because there's so many individuals in the population, mutations constantly creating the double mutants all the time. And even though recombination is breaking them down, the rate of introduction by mutation is winning the game. But then too much recombination out here at large population size, that's 10% recombination, that's free recombination, slows things down dramatically. In other words, we're out where this is governing the process, as opposed to the creation process just as important. Recombinational breakdown is acting as a barrier to adaptation. And so I plotted some data in a slightly different way here to maybe help you understand, help me understand what's going on here. So let's just look at these bottom lines here. This is for a population size of 1 billion individuals, you know, moderate-sized unicellular carryout. And just look at this plot here. 2% selective advantage, this is the kind of thing we've been looking at all along, and intermediate states neutral. And this is the time to establishment, so it's this two-step model, and this is the time to fix the final adaptive allele at different recombination rates. And you can see that it really doesn't make any difference what the recombination rate is, up and from zero up into a rate of 0.01, which would mean crossover one in every 100 meiotic events. And then suddenly, there's literally a threshold effect of recombination here. And Boris, I think you're pretty close to the truth on this. We were talking about this. So this is a 2% selective advantage of the final allele. So now, what does that mean? It means if that final allele appears, it's going to be reproducing exponentially at rate of 0.02, essentially, in the early stages. Well, here's the break point in the behavior of this. It's at a recombination rate of 0.02. So what's going on here? You've got this advantage of 0.02, but recombination's breaking you down at exactly the same rate. And so any further recombination, and you're breaking things down faster than the selective advantage you were procuring. And I don't yet know. This is what I'm hoping you guys and I will sit down and figure out. I haven't had time to, in fact, these data points are running on my computer right now. I don't know exactly why it levels off at this point. There may be a simple explanation. But here's now the result. Same population size, the selected disadvantage of 0.002, and there's the threshold. Recombination rate of 0.002. If the recombination rate exceeds the selective advantage in large populations, sex and recombination is really bad for arriving at the new mutation. And here again, here's the same population size, but now the selective advantage is 2 × 10⁻⁴, and the break point for the recombination rate is 2 × 10⁻⁴. So this seems to be a general feature. These black lines here now we're moving up to, or down to a smaller population size. It takes longer to reach the adaptation as we'd expect. But the breakpoints are right near these thresholds. I assume this one will be here again. But notice that the advantage, and these are becoming flatter and flatter. So in small population sizes, yeah, there's this threshold effect, but biologically it's almost trivial in terms of what it does. And it becomes
recombination rate something that you can actually tweak in biological systems?
I don't think so. That's my opinion, but there's probably 100 papers arguing about the evolution of the recombination rate. This is something I talked about last class on Thursday. The way it can get tweaked indirectly is with genome size changes. And
for these purposes, you're just looking at two loci. Moving them apart effectively will change the rate of recombination, so you can be anywhere.
Right. And yeah, that's right. But you might have been talking about recombination modifier loci or something, or maybe not. Well, one way is just moving the loci, because Boris is absolutely right. Just put the, you have the loci on different chromosomes, and boom, you're up to recombination rate of 0.5.
So can you ever combine the results on the plots that you've got today with the data that you have?
Exactly. This is the next step. That's the next step. So
you can put locus distance for the recombination rate, and then it sort of becomes interesting.
I agree entirely. That's what I want to do next. And maybe we'll get, I'm entirely with you on this. In fact, the next couple slides will be done quickly. But the point here is that it's nice we've got this theory now that I think works pretty well. But, you know, for the theory, you just say, this is the population size, this is the mutation rate, and this is the recombination rate. But there are various combinations of mutation rates and recombination rates that never exist in population sizes. But now they, as I pointed out, so this is a nice lead-in. We want to reduce this down to only looking at what are realistic mutation rates and recombination rates. So I showed you this last class. There's an inverse, and I mentioned this, there's an inverse relationship between the mutation rate per generation and the effective population size. So now we don't have to say treat the mutation rate as an independent. We say, here's the effective population size, the mutation rate will evolve to this. So now we've eliminated one parameter from the model, and I pointed this out before, that this is just population size. It declines with increasing organism size. But we also, here's what we know about the recombination rate. This is the recombination rate per base in different organisms. This comes from a huge number of fine-scale genetic maps. And it's inversely proportional to genome size. The slope here is -1. And the reason you get this behavior is very, very simple. When organisms undergo meiosis, there's essentially every organism we know of, there's typically just one crossover event per chromosome arm. And so organisms with bigger genomes don't typically have bigger genomes because they have more chromosomes. The average chromosome is just bigger. And so you double the length of your chromosome, there's still the same number of crossovers per chromosome, you reduce, it's just an inverse relationship.
But the rate is measured in what units here?
This is the amount of recombination per kilobase.
Per meiotic event.
These guys down here have lower rates of recombination per kilobase. Yeah. These are organisms like flies. The reason is they have larger chromosomes, smaller number of chromosomes, larger chromosomes per that same genome size. So flies only have effectively 3 chromosomes.
So can you plot this instead of a function of genome size as a function of
You could plot it as a function of genome size and chromosome number, and it accounts for about 98% of all variation. And this is why I'm skeptical about recombination modifiers, because almost all the variation among organisms, the recombination rate's a function of genome size and chromosome number. I haven't done the bivariate plot, but I will. I mean, even here you can see probably 80% of the variation is just associated with genome size.
Like in little projects, right?
Much like some variation go away.
Yeah.
But that's where the recombination happens. Is that completely random, or?
No, there's a lot of interesting talk about this. It's thought, I think, increasingly accepted that there are recombination hotspots. This gets into some really strange things that I won't have time to go into, but problem with a recombination hotspot, if it creates recombination, it can also destroy itself as a hotspot. And so the hotspots aren't at the same place, it's thought, for very long periods of time.
It's going to vary a lot across the genome recombination.
Yeah, if there's a dominant hotspot, you could imagine even on the same chromosome, if the two sites have the hotspot in between them, they'd be recombining at higher rates. Over long periods of time, though, if the hotspots are moving around, then it might just average out.
And then what's specifically within genes?
I don't know the answer to that. A lot of the work recently has been on human recombination maps, and only 1% of the human genome is genes, so by definition, they're almost all between genes, just based on gene density in the human genome. So that's...
Be careful, because we're...
That's it.
Oh, it's 12:18.
Yeah, I'm good for... You know, I'm just going to be up here again, so I'll just get tired if I sit down. Yeah.
Just to be fair, since we're trying to put bounds on what recombination can do, what if you were able to select your mates and that sort of restricts the type of recombination events that happen in the population? And imagine it can have huge effects.
Yeah, I'm talking about the mechanical aspects, but you're right. I mean, if you inbreed, you know, there's just as much crossing over, but it's effectively as though, genetically, as though there's no recombination because both sets of chromosomes are identical. That's what you're saying, I think.
That's what many organisms do, like C. elegans. They can effectively choose the number of males in the populations and thereby choose the outcrossing rate.
Yeah. That would cause a global change in the recombination rate, yeah. And you guys have worked on models that sort of have that in it, I think, right?
Another general question about this kind of model. So when you say fitness advantage, you're always talking about relative fitness advantage because the population sizes are fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you pick up a deleterious mutation, in some sense everybody else has become slightly more fit.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any attempt to model that in a more general way by putting in constrained resources and some such?
Well, we've worked on these things called mutational meltdown models in the past and so on. But I mean, the bottom line is selection operates in a relative sense, right? It's how good you are compared to the mean fitness in the population. So it's not the absolute amount of fitness that actually matters in these models, and we think in nature. I mean, the absolute amount matters if it increases your relative fitness, but...
Is it realistic to imagine that using these models you could somehow bound how much, I guess this is what you're trying to do, how much can change over, you know, with real units on the axis? You know,
yeah, that's what I want to do. Now that, so I think we can define the recombination rate and the mutation rate as a function of the population size. And that means now we can go back here, and what I'm envisioning is going back to a plot like this, and these lines won't be like they were before because at each one of these population sites, here everybody's got the same mutation rate and same recombination rate. Here it happens to be zero, but now I want to say, okay, let's vary the mutation rate, let's use the mutation rates and the recombination rates as a function of NE and see what the shape of these is.
I mean, what you'd like to know, like, I guess, is, it would be nice to have, this is very vague, but it would be nice to have somehow a phase diagram where you have, I don't know, different organisms on one axis and the number of different, the complexity of the trait on the other, just sort of bound what can happen given actual numbers.
Yeah, that's right.
So you can sort of look at it and say, you know, over this much time, in real, not in generations, in real, in seconds.
Right.
Right. You know, this is,
yeah, I mean, this is what I'm, that's what we want to know is, based on the biology, you know, our populations of microbial populations versus vertebrate populations, which populations are the ones that are most likely to give rise to adaptations that have to go over these deleterious intermediate states, as opposed to only going up a smooth trajectory where you never, you know, if you can only go up a trajectory where all the intermediate states are neutral, then that really narrows the possible routes to a final adaptation.
Of course, you know, the funny thing about this, though, you know, so this is very nice, but the funny thing about this is if we go back to the first talk of our meeting with endosymbiote, I mean, there are other things that can happen that can promote the evolution of complex traits other than things that are looking at this, and I don't know how likely those are. I mean, you know.
You mean other types of adaptations?
Events, for example, I mean, you know,
yeah.
I mean, what about that, right? This is...
I mean, these are just very generic models at this point,
I mean,
right?
And, you know, this morning scared me sufficiently, but, you know, I mean, can you really get to that from some number of mutations? I mean, I don't know. I think that's not a fair comment.
To some extent, from a point of view of population genetics, the same issues will
They will.
So you have to put them in, but is it beneficial? Is it going to spread?
It will, but the rate at which you put them in, putting in real numbers becomes more tricky. I mean, it just becomes tricky to sort of, you're really trying to estimate time, right? Then you have to No, no, I mean, this is fantastic. I mean, this is the baseline. I mean, it's the thing you have to know before you even start to have a conversation. But still, I just, right, and it could otherwise. I mean, this is the simplest thing, so you should always think the simplest thing.
You know, there are other challenges to putting in numbers. So at the moment, one is looking at, one or two loci at a time, and then all the drift is controlled by population size. Mm-hmm. But if you have lots of things cooking at the same time and they're not all completely neutral, then a lot of this broadening is going to come from something else. And then what one says is, okay, then there is some effective population size. Mm-hmm. But the estimates, strictly speaking, go to pot, because then you have to figure out what that other population size.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's smaller. It's always smaller.
Effective population size is always way smaller than the average population size. Well, not always, but usually.
So the actual population puts a limit on
it. And for the human population, it's historically, the long-term effective size is estimated to only be 10 to the fourth individuals. Right. I mean, there's a lot more of us than that today, but historically, that's the way the genetics is operated. And even a typical unicellular eukaryote is effective size is maybe 10 to the 7th. And you work on Pombi, if they're growing in a flask or something, I suppose you could have 10 to the 7th in one small amount of liquid. But effective population size is associated with all kinds of aspects of population demography and so on. So it's not the same kind of population size that ecologists think about, just the total number of head counts. It's always a lot smaller. And in fact, I think this is probably as big as it gets for anything at all. And what happens in microbes or any organism is eventually the number of individuals you can imagine being an astronomical number. I mean, I guess you could easily have a bacterial population of 10 to the 14th. But what governs the effective population size then, it's not the number of individuals, it's the actual physical linkage of the genome itself. Because what will happen is, you think about a nucleotide here, it's on a chromosome where other deleterious mutations are arising or beneficials, and if a deleterious mutation arises linked to it, it pulls it out of the population, or if a beneficial, it pulls it forward. So this is the thing about chromosomes, alleles don't, if they're linked, they can't evolve independently of their surroundings. And it's the surroundings that actually put an upper limit on the effective size. I really think this is the biological upper limit, which is good for running things on the computer. You don't need to run more than 10 to the 11th individuals.
So if there's nothing pressing, I'd like to propose a trial. He said he doesn't need it, but I think I'm sure that that's true.